pictures that one might go through when on a pilgrimage of their own. So Monday, we looked at setting an intention. Tuesday, we decided what to pack, what we were going to carry with us, and what we most certainly needed to leave behind. If any of you have read the book Wild, or I just think of all these PCTers, I always think of Cheryl Strayed. Reese Witherspoon did a really funny rendering of it when she just tried to put way too much on her back. And she was falling over, and it caused her a lot of discomfort. And sometimes I think that's what the church is trying to do, trying to carry way too much stuff with them into the future. So pilgrimage is an intentional... this is making a lot of noise for some reason. I don't know how to do that. So how do we make decisions, right, about what we need to carry? And it's not to say the stuff that we are carrying with us isn't valuable. It's just not something that's going to be something that we need as we head into the future. And then yesterday we looked, Wednesday we looked at entering the unknown. We talked a lot about blindness, shared stories of blindness. Okay, thank you. Yeah, it was just lots of rustling noises. And just keeping our emotions, like paying attention to where we're at with that. So by way of summary, this has sort of been the liturgy that we've created, so I'm going to kind of go back through. And then, of course, yesterday was welcoming. So here we go. Norms of Christian culture no longer speak to much of today's culture. And when it comes to connecting with others, we do not need to convince them that belief is important. I think a lot of times we think we need to go out and connect with those unbelievers. But when it comes to connecting with people who aren't in our current gatherings, it's not that we have to convince them that belief is important. That is understood. What people fight is the organized, institutionalized casing in which churches currently hold belief. That's on us, not them. And until we figure something out, we will be missing out on their necessary wisdom that we need as they are part of us. So again, it's not an us and them, it's a we, and when part of our body is missing, we feel it. So if it is on us, the ones who have heard the gospel and know its benefits, right, that's language that we use in church, to open up to the rest of our communities, perhaps we need to shift our own understanding of what Jesus' way is. That instead of a fixed path, perhaps his way is open and an adventurous movement, a way of being in the world rather than a fixed, charted course. That rather than a fixed map, we hold a compass and we go out in different directions with a shared heart and then return to one another to celebrate what we have learned. So that was kind of my premise, my... kind of what forced me to embark on this journey to begin with. So to pack for this adventure, we need to bring intention. So this is some of the things we talked about on Tuesday. We need to bring intention. We need to pack curiosity and love, and bring a willingness to be uncomfortable. And in the midst of that discomfort, also a tender desire to provide some safety along the way so that others can be vulnerable and risky. And so now that our bags are packed, entering into the unknown, we're going to be going into places blind. As much as we wanted to know what we were packing for, there is no way that we could fully understand what it is that we are packing for. And so sometimes, perhaps, we may even feel blindsided. So it is important to check in with ourselves, to hold our reactions and emotional responses to the unknown, to hold them authentically. I thought about using the turn phrase to keep them in check, but that almost sounds like we're supposed to control them and suppress them. We will respond to the unknown, and we talked about the one that came out first was fear, right? That's the most normal and natural response to fear, right? It's this kind of like fight or flight kind of thing. So some people may even like lean into it because they decide they're going to fight the change, and some people respond by fright, and so they kind of, in fear, kind of back off from the change. We need to pay attention to that, to hold it, to not suppress it, but then also think, okay, But how do we authentically, knowing that that was our first emotional reaction, how do we authentically move into the unknown so that it can actually be our teacher and we can interact with parts of the body that have been missing from us? Finally, yesterday, we walked headlong into new wisdom and different experiences and values. First, I believe this is our call. I believe it is our call to enter into new wisdom as much as we are able. First, I believe that this is our call to try and simplify who we are as a diverse people only stifles the fullness of who we are. And so, and again, that was that sort of nuance that I kind of plucked out of Ephesians chapter 4, where it says we are not to be tossed to and fro by people's trickery. And I think that being tossed to and fro by people's trickery was that we should really try and simplify things, right? But actually what we are being called to do and to not be tricked into believing that we should simplify things, but we should actually stay present to the diversity that I believe God called us to be, right? So that we, because no one perspective is going to be able to understand the mystery of God, right? We need a breadth of who God has created us to be. As I tell teenagers, I think God created us different for a purpose, but part of the deal. So how do we live into that? And then, what was the second piece of Ephesians? Now I'm forgetting. Oh, that we have to speak the truth to one another in love, right? So that was that other section of chapter 4. It's not just living into this diversity and kind of like burying it, but the willingness to actually speak our own truth to one another. Because I think sometimes we're like, okay, we're all different, so we're just not going to say anything. I talked to you about my visit with my dad, who he and I have very different perspectives on politics, among other things. And after spending the week with him where we weren't actually talking to each other about anything at all, because we didn't want to offend each other, I left a week with him feeling like I hadn't been with him. And so we really need to be able, if we're going to be in relationship with one another, we've got to acknowledge that we're not going to agree with each other. That's okay. But we still have to speak our truth and kind of graciously, tenderly, lovingly live into that discomfort. Yeah.
I'm just having a thought about folks that feel committed to speaking truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
I think make a choice to power instead of love. I think if you're speaking the truth in love, you will have compassion for the other.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're speaking the truth to power, you're doing the same thing there. Mm-hmm. The same thing as the powerful that you look at. I think you're not. I think we're not seeing the other when we get stuck on speaking to power without speaking in love. I mean,
yeah.
I think it's important to speak truth to power.
Yeah.
But if you leave out the love part,
right?
I think it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I mean, my seminary was on the south side of Chicago, where if you didn't speak truth to power, your garbage wasn't going to get picked up, right? I mean, there were sort of certain realities too. So yeah, I wrestle with that. I mean, speaking truth to power is kind of a social justice orientation, right? I'm going to blank on her name. She's from California. She's assistant to the bishop out there. Has written a book, sort of a different kind of organizing. But yeah, I mean, where you're really loving the person that you're talking to, right? I mean, I think we still need to be powerful. I mean, especially if we think there are injustices afoot. I don't want us to stop speaking truth to power because we don't know how to do it lovingly. I think sometimes we need to shout, right?
But they're not mutually exclusive.
Right.
Well, actually, I think if you speak in love, that's direct. And if you do direct communication, that's powerful and can speak to power. It's when we dance around it and, but speaking directly and boldly in love, you can address power, I think, in meaningful ways.
Yeah.
I had two things. It's not Jessamine, is it, that you're thinking? The last name, Jessamine?
No.
Okay. And then secondly, I really was with you and thought that you actually said two different things, and what I came out of it with was when speaking truth to power, if there's no compassion, then I think it doesn't necessarily have the same effect.
Yeah.
You know, like, but I'm not sure that always speaking truth to power doesn't have compassion, because clearly...
No, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, if there is love in there,
then
it can lead to a conversation. But if it's just combative,
right,
then the speaker loses too.
Right.
Fair. Yeah, agreed. All right, so I feel like yesterday the conversation was so good around Ephesians that I just wanted to give more time to that yesterday. So it meant that I kind of left you with this sky woman narrative and then sort of sent you on your way. Have fun, kids. So is there anything now that you kind of sat with her story? For those of you that weren't here, Brady Sweetgrass, Robin Wall or Hall Kimmerer? I'm forgetting her. Hall or Wall?
I think it's
Wall. Wall Kimmerer. She's a scientist and a native Potawatomi person, and has written this beautiful memoir where she dances between story and science and memoir. And Greg and I have both just fallen in love with it. And so I wanted to kind of walk us, since we're in an imagined pilgrimage, into different territory. And so we listened to her tell the creation story. And then she lays it down next to our understanding of Eve and our creation story and how these two stories have shaped very different ways of being in the created world. So I want to give you some room to kind of talk about that today. Yeah.
Yeah, and the second one that you said, I don't know, I must not have been listening well.
Okay.
I kind of came out going, what?
Okay.
And it's just because I don't have a strong background in Native American cosmology, but also, so maybe if you could help us.
I can try and summarize. So, I very much wanted her voice to tell you the story, because at one point I thought, well, a good storyteller worth her spit does it in person, right? And you interact with the people, but it felt a little disingenuous to be telling the Sky Woman story, especially when I had Robin's voice on audiobooks. I could have her bring you the story, because she's just got this lovely voice, and you can hear how it resonates to her very core as she tells it. But it's about a woman, Sky Woman, falling from, they wouldn't say the heavens, but the sky, right? And she comes down, and geese sort of carry her safely to the waters below. But it seems like, you know, the geese can't hold her forever, and she needs a place to stand. And so a turtle swims up and holds her, but it seems like she needs earth, and the animals seem to remember that there's earth below. So there's this whole collaborative and even sacrificial effort to bring earth from the bottom of the sea up to the top. Some animals die along the way so that she might be held safe. And eventually, Little Muskrat comes up with a fistful of dirt, dies in the bringing of it, but is able to spread that over turtle, and she dances with thanksgiving. And as she dances with thanksgiving for the generosity of the created world to support her and coming to earth, the land sort of expands, and she doesn't come empty-handed. Of course, she's swept by the tree of life. I don't know what they call that. That's our language. With a handful of seeds and things that are good for growing in the earth, and eventually the earth turns from brown to green, and animals find their place, and suddenly they're all living together on Turtle Island, full of Thanksgiving. So she, you know, it's this lovely work sacrifice and Thanksgiving and sort of this collaborative, you know, where she brings the gifts of the tree and all celebrate, you know, its goodness. And then she lays that down, and she's like, but that's from one part of the world. And another part of the world, there's another woman in a garden with a tree, right? And what do we know of that woman? Well, she wasn't supposed to eat of the fruit of the tree. And when she did, she was punished. And then part of that punishment was that they were expelled from the garden, and then caring for the earth became toil, right? And even giving birth, I mean, there's sort of this language around giving birth, you know, there was just going to be suffering because of these choices that she had made. And that lays out a totally different relationship between how we understand, I would argue, our relationship to God, right? But also our very much our relationship to the land and how we care for it. And so, and you know, it just kind of makes my heart ache. And so, what do you do with that? I mean, I believe some Sky Woman wisdom I would want to welcome and embrace and take into my bones. But like, how can we live that way? Because we are absolutely terrorizing our earth right now, right? And have it for quite some time. So we need some love language to figure that out. But as a Christian, I wanted to sit Robin down and to be like, you know, there are two creation stories. And the first one in chapter one of Genesis is like God made and said it was good, and God made and it was God created, and on the third day God created and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. You know, and then there's this resting in the goodness on the seventh day, right? When God rested, and just sort of like there's this awe. And I think the second creation story is much more one of humans trying to understand sin in the world. You know, and how sin came to be in the world. And, you know, you can sit me down with a glass of wine and I'll tell you what I think about that one. But I think this is why I think bringing different people into the conversation is essential, right? Because otherwise we kind of get our fixed mindset. Mm-hmm. And to have somebody totally different from us that we might initially have sort of a visceral response. I had found this beautiful picture of Sky Woman, and it's one that, of course, we're going to make me log in again. It's one that Sky Woman, or that Robin Wall Kimmerer has hanging in her lab in a university. And I even thought about showing this to you, but then I thought people might react to her clothing and then decide that they didn't want to hear her story, or they might react to the artist's way of doing this. And sometimes I think, if we can kind of suspend judgment for the sake of wonder, and sometimes visually that keeps us, because we see somebody and we make a judgment about them because of what they're wearing or the way they speak, or, right? I just think this is beautiful, so. but yeah, come back there. Not yet. Okay.
Well, you can do that over here because I can't
see. Oh, sorry. Well, it's your fault for not sitting in community, Mr. Arnold.
Have I been judged?
No, you have been. I just use a dualistic mind all over you. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. So anything else? I mean, about...
Yeah, I had the privilege of teaching a monthly scripture class when I was in charge of campus ministry. And so the Hmong students and I gathered to go, and we started, because I was going to start Gospel of John, and then realized, no, they had no clue. So we went into Genesis, and that's when I learned Hmong cosmology, which is far different than any other creation story, because they don't have a god, per se. And so the story is they come from potatoes, because they're farming people in the mountains of Laos. And as they would unpack that for me, there was a lot of similarities. But that's, I think, the first time I realized there's different views.
Yeah.
And I couldn't begin to explain it, but it was a real privilege to begin to start seeing the world through their eyes.
Yeah. Thank
you.
Yeah, I was attended a chapel service at a homeless center, and we'd get my five or six men would come down after eating their dinner and then come down to chapel. And this one Native American said to the Bible study leader, "What is truth?" And he kind of scratched his head and says, "You know, I don't know that there are too many absolute truths. The only thing I can think of is God is love. God is love." And I think that person could understand that. Because even though being on the street all the time, love isn't too apparent that many, many times. And you're just surviving to to make it to the next day. But I think that helped that person when he could depend that, yeah, God is love.
And again, I think hanging on to some of those things, you know, I keep using this metaphor of a backpack, like what are you going to carry with you? But I think sometimes we try to carry too much, especially when we're encountering something that's, or someone that's totally different from us. But if we can kind of settle in on kind of like a central few, we might be in a far better place to be able to interact with others who are different. Yeah,
that backpack analogy made me think about, you know, the fact that you can't take everything you think you need or want.
Yeah.
And something I've been wrestling with lately is the degree to which I say yes to anything about a dominant world culture right now that I do sort of feel is destructive. The degree to which I say yes to that sort of lends it more support. It gives fuel to the fire, for lack of another better analogy. So I'm wondering if it's helpful to be intentional about not bringing security, because that tends to be the only thing that keeps me saying yes to a dominant culture is, what if I cease to exist because this is the thing that will keep me alive? So I can't imagine what that would look like for people to say, I intentionally want to give up. I think it's going to be hard, and it needs to be harder for this to really work. In other words, if you think and take for granted, I have a house, you know, and the reason you have that house might be because I did work in the system to gain a certain amount of stability slash security. And I'm not sure about how willing people would be to give up those very fundamental and meaningful aspects of security and stability in order to really be on this journey that, you know, we feel summoned to. You know?
Well, another thought on that, and that is, after yesterday, I was thinking how many different stories have informed my life choices.
Right.
And I'm wondering about the story of security, because the story that I heard of security is that you get involved in the system, you work hard, you achieve, you do all these things. And what if that story's not accurate? And so I think really examining what stories have I bought into and how have they informed my choices was really kind of an eye-opener for me. And I think security is a classic example. I bought into the idea that corporate America knows best what my security will be, and we buy into that. And that's a real tough, you know, it's a tough challenge, and it's tough to break away and maybe find other stories that are more meaningful for me. You know?
And if you really are taking on, and there's, beautiful ways that you can kind of keep this metaphor of pilgrimage and almost carry that with you in your daily life. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, that you're going out to some far off distant land. But in this, you know, as I've heard about the Camino de Santiago, which if you know that one is the way of St. James across the northern, it's an ancient pilgrimage trail. It starts kind of in the south of France and then it goes. And my understanding is it can take like a month, 6 weeks. I mean, it kind of depends on how long. So it's not quite the PCT. but it's also very intentionally a faith-based journey, right? And one of the biggest changes that I've heard as it has become so popular that actually breaks my heart is that when you think about like security and what you take with you, it used to be that you didn't do any planning, like where you were gonna stay, right? You had your bag on your back and you just walked. And all the community that's running, you think of angels on the PCT, right? All the people that kind of live along this way, their understanding was, you know, there's bunk houses and there's larger places where Camino pilgrims can go. But it really was kind of this intentional letting go of security. Like, I'm not going to sit here on my phone and figure out where I'm staying tomorrow night. You just go. And if there isn't room for you in that town, then you hike to the next one. But you're incredible. I mean, you end up being surprised at how loving and caring people are, and how, you know, whether it's other hikers or people in the town who don't normally take people in, but there is a learning that happens. And I even think about that coming to Holton. It's like what we pack and what we didn't pack, and if we bring everything, then we don't need our community members to support us with the stuff that we did bring, right? Greg and I are already lamenting the fact that we've loved being in housing where there's a bunch of people there, because it may be as long-term staff that we're going to be in our own apartment. And then I'm like, well, then who do we hang out with? Like, we came home last night, and other people in the Schley were there, and we sat and chatted for an hour. It's great. When we kind of let go of, because, you know, my homies would say, oh, you need privacy, right? That's important. Because you need a place to come down and be yourself and blah, blah, blah. But then you miss out on all this other stuff. So, yeah. So I really want to walk us into how we go home. And I don't know if any of you have perfectionist bones in your body. I have several. I'm a first child, and so I think I come by it honestly. And there's a sense of, you know, wanting to kind of have this all wrapped up in a neat little bow, and then you come home with, like, the perfect understanding of how you will go. And so I think part of pilgrimage is really honoring our own brokenness, our own messiness, and being okay with it. Not like pilgrimage is going to fix it. But pilgrimage helps us hold it. And so I picked one of my favorite Bible stories for today, Jacob. And so let us take some time to look at that today, and then I have kind of some closing words that I will share with you as well. So there's kind of a short paragraph there, starting with Jacob sent, and then a second paragraph that begins, the messengers returned. And then the other two are a little bit more obvious where the break is. So if I could have four people that would be willing, the first shorter paragraph starting at verse 3, if there's somebody that would be willing to read that. And then the messengers return to Jacob saying, somebody that would be willing, do you want to do that? Thank you. And then the third paragraph, it's a short one. So he spent that night there. Somebody willing to read that? Okay, thank you. And then the last one, the same night he got up and took his two wives. Somebody willing to read that?
22.
Yeah, 22 forward.
Yes,
sir. Okay, great.
There's two different spellings of the place. So which way do you want it pronounced? Or maybe it doesn't matter. Talk about perfectionist. P-E-N-I-E-L or P-E-N-U-E-L?
U-E-L.
Hey, you know what? I just cut and paste this from a biblical. It's really spelled differently.
It's spelled with an I, isn't it? I think it is. So
What verse? I'm seeing it and
at the very last,
at the very bottom.
It's
of
30th.
Oh, yeah.
And 31st.
Yep.
I think the first one is the correct.
The first one? Is it Peniel?
It's traditional. I won't say correct.
Okay.
Because
I just, I'll have to go look at that to see if that was a typo or if that was, because I'm now wondering about the Hebrew and if there was some different nuance that's in here, because I don't remember that part.
Okay, I'll just do my best.
Bless you for not seeing. Thank you for noticing that and sharing that. Great. All right, so. Let us begin. Yeah.
Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have lived with Laban as an alien and stayed until now, and I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, males, and female slaves. And I have sent to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight.
Okay, I'm going to hold you right there because I just realized this is sort of the end of a long story and I want to make sure we know the Jacob story. So I'm going to try to do this really fast. Jacob was a twin. He and his brother Esau were born at the same time. Esau was born first. He came out of the womb first. Jacob came out grasping his heel, which was sort of like. So Esau really connected with his father Isaac. And Jacob really connected with his mother, Rebecca. And there was family rivalry, right? And so it turned out that Jacob ended up stealing not only Esau's inheritance, but also his blessing. So in Isaac's dying days, he went to bless his beloved and favorite son Esau, but he was going blind. And so Jacob and his mother worked this whole, you know, shenanigans, right? And he got the blessing of his dad. And so he basically, Esau was ready to kill his brother over this, and he had to flee for his life. He ended up going to the land of his mother's family, which is where his uncle Laban lived. There he met and married the love of his life, Rachel. But on their wedding night, they ended up switching, and then he ended up marrying her sister, Leah. Like, how does that even happen? I don't know. But he ended up being married to Leah and Rachel, and then there were some other women in that world. They had multiples, I guess. But the good news about this story is that then under Laban's rule, and even though Laban was kind of jealous and wanted to keep Jacob, that was part of the trickery there, he ended up growing a rather large family and well-being, and so he's kind of coming back to this scenario many years later with a lot of wealth, a lot of accumulated wealth and power because of this great family. But that said, he's still terrified about how his brother is going to receive him after all this time. And I think Jacob has kind of come to this understanding that he's a bit of a screw-up. Like, he's a little bit worried that his brother's death threats way back when still exist. Yeah. And that his safety may be in jeopardy. So if you could cue the sort of tension music in the movie theater, that's kind of what's happening at this point. Okay, sorry. That's the Jacob story in like under 2 minutes. All right, go ahead and start at verse 9, verse 6. I can't read.
The messengers returned to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him, and the flocks and herds and camels into two companies, thinking, if Esau comes to the one company and destroys it, then the company that is left will escape.
Okay. Well, I guess, yeah, if you want to keep going.
Both are in here.
Right.
Oh. Peniel is what he
and Jacob said, "Oh God, my father Abraham, and God, my father Isaac,
and Peniel is a place.
You said to me,
Peniel,
return to your country and to your kindred, and I will do you good.
Yeah.
I am not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I am afraid of him. He may come and kill us all, the mothers with the children. Yet you have said, I will surely do you good, and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted because of their number."
So he spent that night there, and from what he had with him, he took a present for his brother Esau. For he thought, "I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me, and afterwards I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me." So the present passed on ahead of him, and he himself gave that night in the camp.
Really, verse 22. Who had the last paragraph?
Was that you?
Yeah.
My sister found in the Bible that there are two different places.
Yeah. Both are good.
Okay.
The same night he got up and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and likewise everything that he had. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket and saw Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then the man said, "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved. The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip.
Yeah, now I want to go back to the, and look at, because, you know, names are not just sort of happenstance in Scripture. They all have names, and they bring a deeper meaning to what's going on in the text. So I want to go back and look up Peniel and Penuel and see what it is that they're telling us. Because, like, Jacob's name means grasping, or, you know, different people's names have, it's kind of fun once you start digging into that stuff. So take a moment to talk to somebody around you of what you noticed in the story. Or do we want to just do this as a big group? Should we do it as a big group?
Yeah,
that's kind of what I'm feeling today too. So I wanted to honor the introverts in the group. It's easier to talk to somebody next to you. But we've been together all week, so what do you notice in the story?
The son of Shiloh. The thing that jumps out at me in the story, this man and his character sends his wives and kids ahead of him just in case they do plan on slaughtering, and he stays protected. Every time I read this, I go, what in the world?
He is pretty much a hot mess, Jacob.
At the end of the journey, he's embraced by God.
I noticed when he did talk about his wife, his two wives, his beloved children, not his beloved wives and beloved, two wives and beloved. Loved his children, but
there's a lot of tension between sisters, Rachel and Leah. The story of Jacob and Rachel meeting is just, it's one of the great love stories of Scripture. It's great. She's like a shepherdess and is coming out of the hills, and he removes this big heavy stone that should have taken multiple shepherds to move so that she could water her flock. And they, it's great. It's like Hollywood, but... Leah very much becomes part of that story and ends up bearing him more children than Rachel did, and then Rachel ends up dying in childbirth later too. But
I thought it was kind of ironic in verse 10, he says, I am not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness, and then when he's wrestling, although he says he's not worthy, he then says, I will not let you go until I get your blessing.
Wikipedia, which is all I can find right now.
Wikipedia.
Sorry.
Says, are you bringing your phone out right here in the middle of Holden?
Yes.
Thank you. What wisdom have you found, dear brother?
Well, here it says that's it's a different name for the same place.
Okay. Oh, thank you. We're still back to Peniel and Penuel.
Well, it's the name, because it does, it says here that it means face to face, or face of God.
Yeah.
Peniel, I-E-L, face of God. So where did you see that it's two?
In the Bible. In verse 31, there's another one at the very end.
And it says they're the different places?
On your sheet.
It said the sun rose upon him as he passed. Peniel, or however.
Well, Peniel is in this, is along with Peniel. So it's two spellings, but they say it's the same place.
Okay.
So,
well, they can have it that way if they want.
I'm a messenger.
Let's go back to Jacob.
You know what happens to some messengers?
Yes. And I'm a candidate.
You know, I think this is interesting because even when, and I've watched husbands and wives do this with each other. I've watched sisters do this with each other. It's usually family members where, you know, they start to tell the story of the journey that they've just been in and they end up arguing over one small detail and like you lose the whole heart of the journey and the meaning they're in. We do this as church people all the time. I've actually, the younger of my stepsons is very detail focused and he likes to kind of correct us on things. Like he'll just be trying to go along and tell a story and then he's always correcting you. I'm like, man, you're messing with my flow. So again, I mean, this is even, and how do we carry this journey forward? There may be even, as a community gathers, like how do we claim what's at the heart of this? And sometimes you can't even get to the heart of it because you're kind of wrestling with some of the small details on the periphery. So other than his willingness to send his family ahead of him, Greg noticed at one point he sort of seems to be like, I'm not worthy of you know, good graces or whatever, but then later is like, I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. This was pointed out to me by one of our one of my seminary professors. Do you notice the language of who Jacob's wrestling with? Like, let me ask a survey. How many of you think Jacob was wrestling with an angel? How many of you think Jacob was wrestling with God?
I don't know.
Those tend to be the most common. Anybody think that he was wrestling actually with his brother?
It says a man.
I think he's wrestling with himself.
With himself, yeah.
Confronting his own demons before he
And I think it's important, and this is where I'm able to kind of hold this story a little bit more lightly. I think God can work through all those things, whether he was wrestling with himself or wrestling with his brother or wrestling with an angel. I think in all of those, he truly is wrestling with God, and I think that's an important context. That on our pilgrimage journey as we head home, that we look at the different encounters that we've had, that we look at the different wrestlings and joys, and that we count those all as being in divine presence. Yeah? Because we tend to, again, the dualistic mind, we tend to be like, well, these things were of God, and these things clearly weren't. Thank you. I was just about to do that. not often I get a ukulele in the background. It's great. So as you kind of look back on the journey that you've been and what you're carrying home, to really trust that God was working through all of it. And the soul of a pilgrim. Our author says this is why we embark on pilgrimage, to rediscover what it is that we already know most deeply within ourselves. And even the act of embarking on a pilgrimage is kind of a coming home. And I guess this is what I'm hungering for the church. I think we need to come home to our true self, our true embodiment of the gospel, and to figure out how to do that.
How do you know what it is?
That's a good question. How do we know what it is?
If it gives life.
If it gives life. So there might be some qualifiers that we decide. We know what it is if it's giving us life.
Well, as Lutherans, we follow the 3-year calendar.
Yep.
So there you go. That's it. There's not a lot of leeway. We don't deviate very often. We don't bring in guest speakers very often. You do the calendar. That's it.
And I know there are some Lutheran communities that have chosen to deviate. It's not like the bishop is going to come down on you if you do, right? Especially during the green season, those are pretty common. So from Pentecost to him and Lutheran Church, the Reformation in October. That's a big long reading season, and it's a common time where we can kind of, but I know a lot of churches have decided to go with the narrative lectionary, acknowledging that our three-year lectionary is snippets, and you don't ever really hear stories in their full context. And the more and more people that are coming into our Christian communities that don't have the biblical background, and frankly, for generations, I'm not sure that we have had it in the same way as maybe perhaps we once did, but so there's a new narrative lectionary that some churches are choosing to work with so that you can kind of walk through the story front to back, where I don't just throw a little tail end of Jacob at you because that's what is assigned, but we've actually spent a couple weeks together so you have the full understanding of who he is in this context.
Well, I like that because I think, you know, you really can't tell about Moses and listening to the Sunday service. I mean, some days he's baby and some days he's getting people.
And it jumps back and forth.
Yeah.
And yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Yeah. So how do we come to, how do we arrive at it? Say your question again. How do...
How do you know what the right thing to talk about is? I mean, you've got the Bible, but how do you present it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm all about letting people know the story.
Yeah.
And how the story's affected the people.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when we have our lectionary, we get the little stories, and they assume we know the big story. But as we want to bring in the odd church, it's hard to do that.
Yeah.
And yet, do we then, to that girl, then do we focus on words, perhaps? You know, wisdom, gentleness, within our story. And
I just think, you talked about stories, and then the stories that we have are written by humans.
Mm-hmm.
The Bible is written by humans. And so to the degree that a church is risky enough or open enough or diverse enough to bring in others' stories to expand so that there's not just one story that we grapple with. But I mean, I don't think many traditional churches are willing to bring in others' stories because it almost seems like it's in competition or it may undermine the belief system of the people in that church. And so I think that's a real challenge that we have. To what degree are we really broadening our thinking to embrace all of God's world and not just the stories that we've been exposed to?
Mm-hmm.
And are you thinking like the monk story where you came about the jail or the turtle story?
Well,
that type of story?
Well, considering that, you know, Clara, at least we have a very large Hmong population,
right,
and we have some native population, but I think, like you're saying, I'm thinking of that, and I'm not saying there's an easy way, but I'm just wondering, is that one way that we might expand a little bit in terms of recognizing our story may be interpreted differently by other people, and we're all still within this one body?
Yeah, and I think that's where some churches are so strict, they don't want be told their story,
give
them a story.
Yeah. It's a larger word, and there's an active work of discernment going on, right? And it's noticing things like what are you hungering for, but also I think there's a certain amount of resonance, like call, you know, oftentimes for like as a pastor, there's an external call and there's an internal call, right? So. And then there's also an educational institution that has to decide whether or not I've graduated. So, I mean, there's, because if it's just one person with a fire in their belly and they seem to be an island unto themselves, you know, maybe that's not truly, but it's when, you know, not to say that we should ignore that person, but I think when it really comes to what a community is moving towards and what are the priorities, I think you got to pay attention to the hunger. I keep doing this because, you know, it's something that you kind of feel in your belly, right? But what is it that's giving us life? Is it embodying love? You know, I mean, you think of the sacrifice that Jesus made and a lot of the ways that he lived his life. You know, the welcoming the stranger and the hospitality to the less likely, right? That these are in tune. And this is why I think community is essential in different opinions, because a lot of times we think we've got it right, but then you have, you know, these two people over here that start talking, and you're like, oh, and it kind of hones the path. So I would very much say, you know, that you do it collaboratively, that you go, pilgrimage is oftentimes an individual pursuit, but I really want to live into this model of how do we do it as a community, because I think we need that dialogue along the way. It's terrible, I'm blanking on her name and I wish I'd grabbed the book, but the woman who wrote the Soul of a Pilgrim, she met with her spiritual director and found that her spiritual director was asking her, what is your purpose, right? And it's not what you do for work, it's not even your list of priorities for the day, but it's your purpose as a human being, being in this life. And this idea of pilgrimage, the path of pilgrimage, brings us intimately in touch with that question. So that as coming home after you've been through a journey, that the church, you know, or the community should be able to have a deeper sense. I mean, you are going out into the unknown, you are embracing new wisdom, but a lot of that should be able to hone your own sense of purpose. My post-grad days took me to an evangelical seminary outside Portland, and I realized how Lutheran I was. And that said, I also found a deep appreciation for the way different people read scripture and why. Because I'm not a biblical literalist, but I was in class with a lot of people who were. And I understand the beauty of that far more deeply than I ever did. I used to think of evangelicals as the evil other, right? It didn't change who I was as a Lutheran person, but I think it changed Melinda to be more compassionate and to maybe experience their own passions with wonder and curiosity and respect. When we arrive home from pilgrimage, we discover that life is fuller than we had noticed before. That we can and have the ability to embrace joy and sorrow, plenty and want, sickness and health, right? All the stuff that comes up as you're talking about entering into the journey of a committed relationship to another, conflict and times of peace. That there is space for the fullness of our own human expression. I said I was going to read this quote to you from Barbara Brown Taylor. It's interesting. She, in the conclusion to this book, she wanted to explore the idea of darkness and how we tend to kind of fret darkness. And she really kind of wanted to live into it. So she did some caving. She went to this museum that was led by a blind person, and everybody went through the museum experience blind and had to figure out what that felt like. There are certain aspects of her, you know, bringing family members to her farm where there's not light. So probably like Holden Village if you were to walk out the trail without a headlamp. And she does just some wonderful theological reflection on some of these things. So this is now at the conclusion of her book, and just sort of laughing at the fact that she wishes she could know what she's going to write before she sits down to write it, but it never seems to work out that way. And so this is part of her closing reflections. Pema Chodron did not become one of my teachers. I don't know if you know Pema, but we did wonderful retreats with her, Buddhist, right? Suddenly I was guessing myself. You want to talk about beautiful new wisdom, perhaps outside the Christian context, but speaks so beautifully to so much of who we are as a Christian people. Barbara Brown Taylor writes, Pema Chodron did not become one of my teachers until I had almost finished writing this book. But she diagnosed the problem so well that I can no longer say it without her help. We are all so busy constructing zones of safety that keep breaking down, she says, that we hardly notice where all the suffering is coming from. We keep thinking that the problem is out there, and the things that scare us, like dark nights, dark thoughts, dark guests, dark emotions, If we could just defend ourselves better against those things, we think, then surely we would feel more solid and secure. But of course, we are wrong about that, as experience proves again and again. The real problem has far less to do with what is really out there than it does with our resistance to finding out what is really out there. The suffering comes from our reluctance to learn to walk in the dark. So I would pray in our own homecoming that it's not just a, oh, thank God we're home and I have all my comforts and I get to go back to life as usual, right? But perhaps it's even reshaped the way we go about our daily life. And so I'm actually, oh gosh, it's after 10. How did I do that? I know some of you are actually leaving today, but take time to think about, you know, set an intention for going home. What do you want to carry with you? And, you know, and I would recommend doing something physical, right? Like writing it on a post-it note and